I'd like to welcome you all today to the continuation of the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. To kick things off today, it is my pleasure to introduce Robert Bergeneau, who is the Chancellor of the Berkeley campus.
Thank you so much, Judd. And of course, I already spoke to a number of you on 2 days ago on Monday morning, and I understand the first 2 days have been terrific. And I apologize for missing last night's banquet, but I was up in Sacramento. That's a thing we public university leaders spend these days more and more time doing, but actually we made a presentation on Berkeley's initiatives in global climate change and energy self-sufficiency, which is having a big impact. We're very happy about it. Anyway, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's symposium, which celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. And it's wonderful to see so many guests and CHSE alumni here, both from on campus and from around the world. As all of you know, the Center for Studies in Higher Education is one of Berkeley's jewels. Founded in 1956-57 as the first center in the United States focused on higher education policy issues, it led the way in developing higher education as an important field of study, both nationally and internationally. Having spent a lot of my career in one of the elite privates, MIT, and then having the privilege of leading two large publics, one in Canada and now one in the United States, obviously I can think of nothing that's any more important than higher education, including the diversity and the different kinds of challenges that different kinds of institutions face. With a distinguished past that has contributed significant research to higher education policy issues, both in California as well as nationwide and throughout the world, the Center for Studies in Higher Education is now looking ahead to examine issues that will face the future of higher education in an increasingly globalized world. And I remarked on Monday morning, and I'll repeat it, last Friday I had took out to dinner two friends of mine, one of whom just stepped down as the head of Humboldt University, and the other of whom is the head of Germany's largest national laboratory, who are here together trying to understand how large national scientific efforts, national laboratories and universities should work together for the benefit of both of them. Berkeley, obviously, with Lawrence Berkeley Lab here in our campus, you know, represents one model for how you do that. And it was just very interesting talking through with them all of the challenges that the German system specifically faces in marrying large scientific efforts and universities and the implications for both undergraduate and graduate education. And I learned a lot from my German friends, but they also learned a lot for how we do things here in the United States. It became very clear, and I'd had previous experience with this, just how different approaches are in different countries in the world. And we all can learn from each other. And in an increasingly globalized society, students need to be able to move comfortably between different countries and between different educational systems, and we need to figure out how to bring compatibility between them. On this very special occasion of the Center's 50th anniversary, I, of course, want to congratulate Judd King on his visionary leadership of the Center. His leadership follows in the tradition of fine scholars and practitioners of higher education reform who have held this office. And I believe several of our most distinguished colleagues who, as former directors of the Center, have helped shape and build its leadership are here. This includes Neil Smeltzer, Professor Emeritus of Sociology, Sheldon Rothblatt, who I guess will be on the panel, Professor Emeritus of History, UC Berkeley. I see on the list Chancellor Mike Heyman, but I haven't seen Mike yet. Is Mike here? He was. Okay. And I did see UC Santa Cruz Chancellor Emeritus Carl Pister. Carl also was here. Carl, you here? There he is, over there. for all of his contributions to the UC system. He's getting his final punishment because for locals, because we asked him to take charge of the stadium renovation project, which has meant he's had to deal with things as varied as digging trenches to look for possible traces of the Hayward Fault, to dealing with about 70 people who took off their clothes to pose in the trees in front of the stadium as a protest. It's Berkeley, after all. Very sadly for us, Martin Tro, Professor Emeritus of Public Policy, who headed the center from 1977 to 1988 and helped establish its international stature, passed away this past month. In closing, let me thank the Carnegie Corporation for its support of this conference. And indeed, it was the Carnegie Corporation that provided the initial grant funding for the foundation of CHSE 50 years ago, and we're most grateful for their support. I also had the privilege of just having a coffee with Susan Beresford. Susan, where are you? In the back of the Ford Foundation, who also were one of the early funders of CHSE, so we're also grateful to the Ford Foundation. We're grateful to anybody who will help us do what we need to do. I'd also like to recognize and thank CSHE's co-host of this conference, the Berkeley Roundtable on the International Economy, as well as the Institute for International Studies here at Berkeley. So it's clearly, looking at the program, you have a very stimulating program ahead of you, and I'm sure you will have a terrific time. And I just and we got glorious Berkeley weather for you today as well. So I wish you a really wonderful and productive day. Thank you.
Bob mentioned the very important role of the Carnegie Foundation, a Carnegie Corporation, excuse me, of New York. One has to keep one's nomenclature straight. Their very important role in the founding of the center. Indeed, it was three luminaries of higher education in the United States who cooked up this idea. John Gardner, who was then the president of the Carnegie Corporation, Robert Gordon Sproul, a name that will be familiar to people at Berkeley, and Clark Kerr, a name that will be familiar to people everywhere. And it was the three of them who came up with the idea. Now, you notice there's some ambiguity with regard to the starting date being 56 or 57. This is because the Carnegie Corporation made the grant in 1956, and in its deliberative wisdom, the Academic Senate of the Berkeley campus of the University of California took until 1957 in order to establish the organized research unit. And those who are denizens of UC will recognize the process at play there. So that is why we choose 2007 in order to do this. We are most appreciative that the Carnegie Corporation has agreed most energetically to provide support for this event here. Very fitting, considering their role in the start of the center. And we did hear from one representative of Carnegie, Narciso Matos, those of you who were at dinner last night. And we have here with us today Daniel Fallon, who chairs the Education Division of Carnegie, and you will be hearing from him later today. Why did we choose this subject matter of globalization and higher education? That's my introduction to John Douglas, who's going to come up here next and give us a few thoughts on that subject. And following that, we will proceed to the first panel.
Thanks, Judd. When we were imagining what to do next at the center, we of course thought that to some extent the event should be a welcome welcome back. Welcome to the community that the center has represented for over 50 years. So in both real time, you hear, and then there are many others who've shown interest in the things we've posted on the web and will post on the history of the center and all the publications. You know, it's really about, to a large degree, about community building. But another aspect is, of course, is to look towards the future and what are the big issues that lie out there. And in a way, we flipped the table a little bit, and that is that there are many conferences and activities that go on throughout the world that often include, well, what can we learn from the U.S. about higher education? For, you know, the U.S. really is really introduced the concept of mass higher education and has been doing this for over 100 years in some form, so we have a lot of experience and there's a lot of successes. But that has also kind of bred a kind of isolationism that fits into an overall political milieu well beyond higher education that we all know. And so we thought, well, we'll kind of flip that table and say, well, what can we start learning from the other parts of the world? Because if you look at participation rates, you look at various kinds of indicators of development in higher ed, the world has changed remarkably in the last 30 year, plus years, but really rapidly. And so in conjunction with this conference, we had a meeting, many of you have participated in it the last several days, to ask that question, what can we learn from other parts of the world? And so now to this conference is to have kind of a more general, broad discussion about trends. I think Judd's leadership has been fantastic in this area of trying to keep, not exclusively, but that the center really continues the tradition of having an international viewpoint. This is part of the impetus of what we're doing here. And it does date back very far, even though there's been fits and spurts, shall we say, over time about the international focus of the center. But, you know, T.R. McConnell was doing work on UK higher ed, and so there's various colleagues have been very active over the period looking at international ed conditions. So that's at least kind of one conceptual idea we have. So what the structure of the conference kind of goes like this. We have kind of three kind of goals. One is, how have international models influenced the development of national higher ed systems and institutions over the past 50 years, or kind of taking a glimpse of what is it like in 1957 and then bringing it up to date. So that's kind of a phase one. If we have a kind of an outline of the focus of the event online if you want to read more. And then how is globalization now influencing national higher ed systems and institutions? It's very different, really. And higher education markets. And what we will call phase two, a kind of a different kind of condition. And then, of course, you know, then, now, future, a simple tripartite approach is what's going to happen in the future. So you'll see that the program kind of reflects that. Now let me just say, what is that phase one? And I should also note we have people on the panels who have done much research on the issues of globalization in higher ed and have a much more nuanced and sophisticated way of putting it, and we'll hopefully delve into that. What is internationalism versus globalization? You know, is there a difference? What was the model like in the late 50s and early 60s? But I think in a simplistic way, you could say that in this earlier period, it had more to do with kind of a rather simplistic looking at other models. Was there some things that could be used in them? There were, of course, traditions that go well before the late 50s of, you know, of international models influencing national development. So German higher education, as we heard in a session the other day at the symposium we had, was very influential in the initial development of Chinese higher education. And then they moved to a Soviet model. So you have these kinds of structural things. But so what's the phase one of globalization or internationalization? One is a limited adoption of international higher ed models. Things like community colleges, this conceptual idea that didn't necessarily come to fruition, but it did have, if you look at things like England, it had some relationship to the further education sector. National and regional markets for undergraduates. Marginal international market for faculty and research, and that might be generous, except for in the U.S., that was one of our market advantages. Higher educational institution, limited accountability measures. Government as a partner with higher ed community, a sense of mutual trust, let's say, and of how to build these systems to some degree. National accreditation and quality review. Traditional pedagogy, limited technological adoption, of course. Substantial government subsidization. Small for-private sector. And if you look at the for-private sector in the 1950s, well, basically you're talking about the U.S. Beginning of a burgeoning scientific community. And limits on cross-national knowledge sharing and communications. So what's the more kind of contemporary aspects of globalization? A partial list. One is growing adoption of international higher ed models in some form, Bologna, the Bologna Agreement, other kinds of supranational frameworks that are growing. Growing international and growing international market for faculty and research talent. Eroding institutional autonomy to some degree, growing accountability measures, government as an adversary, or let's say a critical partner with the higher ed community, possible international accreditation and quality review, changing pedagogy, relating to growing technological developments, declining government subsidization, and rising sources of private. Sources of funding, including fees, and you see this through major parts of the world. It's a trend. It's going to proliferate. Growing for-profit sectors, a very established scientific community and a more competitive kind of sense of how to build that, not just being a national framework, but an international framework. And, of course, global knowledge sharing and communications, which all fits into this. So these are at least some of the things that that help differentiate what it was like 50 years ago plus and what it's like now. So that gives you kind of the general sense of what we thought we were doing. And I know that that is a fairly ambitious agenda. We aren't really going to get into everything, but I think it should be a productive day. So I think we're ready for our first panel. Thank you.
While our distinguished panelists resolve the complex problem of where they're supposed to sit, first let me say good morning again. My pleasure and being invited to participate in this symposium. And with that, Sheldon.
I realize that there is a kind of an echo in this room, so I'll try to compensate for that. Erwin, thank you very much. I want to say how lovely it was for you to come to Nether Berkeley, and listening to you over the last few days, let me say all your performances were with con brio. Just marvelous. Now that I've flattered you, can I have my statutory 3 hours? Is that all right? Okay. I'm not going to talk about money, not that much. We've spent a couple of days talking about money. It's always underrated anyhow. So who needs money? Let's talk about something else. And what I'd like to speak about is a subject that I've just finished investigating and published a book on, which began when I was invited to Oxford a few years ago to comment on a flap that had occurred there regarding that perennial blister access and who gets into universities that are called elite. What I'd really like to talk about is an old-fashioned issue that's going to persist, that has persisted, that seems to me cannot go away, and which was not initially caused by globalization or internationalization, but is much exacerbated by it. The strains and stresses that the higher education communities of the world are undergoing at the moment are intensifying a particular kind of problem, which I will identify with societies that have reached a state which I will call a pluralistic democracies, that is composed of many different kinds of groups, divided according to class, culture, ethnicity, religion, and there are some other variables as well. that now help identify different groups. Are they handicapped? Gender issues get into this, and so on. There are many different ways in which a pluralistic democracy can be discussed, but I'm not going to do that because it would take me beyond the 3 hours that have been allotted. So I will keep it shorter. But let me put the problem this way. Who gets into universities historically is not a subject that's been much studied because the evidence and the records are very difficult to read if you go back hundreds and hundreds of years. Entries are often enough in Latin. They can't be translated easily into vernacular languages. We're not quite sure who got in, although we have a very good idea that those who entered universities for hundreds of years were almost always from the privileged members of society, and we would define privilege according to criteria existing at various times. We haven't studied who was rejected. Those records would be even more difficult to interpret, but they are available, and someday somebody might want to do that. Who is it that doesn't get in historically? And my answer, tentative answer, would be, my suspicion would be, that they're the same sort of people who did get in. Okay? We don't really know the criteria that were used to for people to enter into society, but we do know that that is a major question for us. And it really becomes a major question in the course of the 19th century for the three societies that I have particularly studied, Scotland, England, and the United States, over a 200-year period. I welcome thoughts about other societies. I have my suspicions about how those systems worked as well. The tensions that are increasing the difficulties of selection, particularly for institutions that in some sense define themselves as elite. There is a definition of that, but let me leave it aside for the moment. The problem is that, as we understand, there's ferocious competition on a global scale for all kinds of talent, student talent, labor market talent, professorial talent, research talent. As that talent search increases and is enhances, the problem of who gets into universities that are elite, legacy, and so on, is enhanced. The two international movements are working against one another. The more the selection process is stressed as a meritocratic process based on competitive criteria, the more difficulty that causes for those who cannot compete. The more emphasis that is put on policies that we call by various names, affirmative action, diversity, recruitment of students from disadvantaged homes, the more policy emphasis that is placed on that, the more the talent selection process is compromised. The two are working against one another. I examined that in some historical detail to show how those tensions first arose and what the consequences of them were. And into that equation, one would really have to put the growth of national systems of education with linkages between the various levels, from primary to secondary, to middle schools to secondary, and secondary on to tertiary, and so on. And examining those transition points really gives you a sense of how structural systems are created that make this whole process enormously complicated. Getting students up from one level to another, into another, and then into the preparatory level for universities. Scotland and England, with very different educational heritages, solved this in various ways until the end of the 19th century, when they solved them the same way as most European countries did, by linking the upper secondary clearly to the universities and allowing for a common culture at the, let's say, French lycée or the English public boarding school or the French upper secondary with its higher's examination, preparing those students to go on. So getting into the upper secondary was really the issue. The United States had to do it quite differently, beginning from a different conception of what a democratic society would be, concerned about opportunity, and finding it very difficult all along, especially in the period of immigration and afterwards, to create a system in which selection could easily be managed from secondary schools into universities. And then if you study then the history of American universities, you'll see them constantly struggling with the high schools in order to get a qualified student body so they don't have to do what in fact we do and have done, use the first year, maybe beyond, as remedial instruction. So those two phenomena are going on. Pressure to recruit talent at the very highest level, pressures to see that a democratic promise is upheld. And there are two different kinds of democratic promises. One is that to create societies through public policy measures, usually state intervention, that will allow for what we call level playing fields, that people should start life at the same level, even though we know they don't, because family circumstances are so different. And the other is to deal with the frustrations of policies that have failed to do that and to try to make outcomes more equitable. That is the basic situation and the tension. There are all sorts of additional problems that get into there as well. Changes in the curriculum and in the structure of curriculum, and particularly in societies that have not had a system that, like the American, for which we have no name, credit unit, module, but the idea of chopping up a degree program into tiny bits and pieces, all of which facilitate the transfer process, which has not been very widely observed in Europe and is only being briefly talked about now in connection with Bologna or something else. Okay, but the more one does that, the more the difficulty of maintaining quality increases. We all know that the courses taught in any university are not in some sense intellectually equivalent. We can't talk about that very openly because it would be insulting, but we do talk about that in our offices with our students when informally they ask us for advice on courses to take, and we say, don't take that one. But we can't speak this very openly. But that, if you think about it, modular systems really raise quality problems, all kinds of quality problems. All sorts of pedagogical instructions of a problem-based learning, for example, all sorts of innovations of that kind, group work, all raise questions of how you evaluate students. All of that is going on in order to make our institutions more flexible, to accommodate different interests, to reach out to wider communities with different sorts of specialties and perhaps knowledge bases, but all of that enhances and makes more difficult the quality question. And a final point, I think, in this, to give some sense of a phenomenon which could be discussed at many more levels, the incidence of cheating in the world in school and in university has, to all apparent purposes, gone up dramatically, really gone up, enhanced by the pressures to succeed because so much is being put on getting into the right institutions, although we're still not clear whether getting into the right institutions at the tertiary level gets you into the right labor markets. That's another issue that we have not really explored at all. And if you go down into specific occupations and try to figure out how they recruit and who is successful in those occupations, you get a very interesting story indeed, which doesn't link up very precisely with the notion that if you go to a brand name institution, you will get a brand name job in society. It doesn't work that way. It'd be a very nice research project to try to go beyond the sort of data that we do have. But what has really made increased cheating, beside the pressure which accounts for the phenomenon, is the electronic means of cheating. And there have been any number of remarks about that. Students bringing cell phones to the classroom where they can get text messaging from friends. Boy, that is a challenge to write an examination where you really can't do that. I was always happy that I thought I could write an examination that no one could cheat on. But the attempt is always made. The computer and the laptop, and this has led to all sorts of countermeasures in the world of trying to make buildings that have what we've laboriously and expensively equipped to be smart, to be less smart and to be dumb so they can't use the internet to download information. And all other ways in which classic student ways of bringing information to class, breaking your arm and writing on the cast, not recommended, but done, and a million other ingenious ways to try to get under the net of proctorial supervision to get those grades, to download examinations from the internet and to submit that. This is a worldwide phenomenon. Some interesting moral questions have arisen, with some faculty members saying, I wonder if students understand that this is really a moral problem in a university, that honesty and truth-telling and integrity are really lie at the essence of scholarship. Maybe they don't know that, and therefore we should excuse the fact that they have cheated. I can't believe that that sort of argument is being made and discussed in academic courts and senates, but it is. It is. It seemed to me in an old-fashioned way, I'm going to end here, is that the way in which I was taught that you handle cheating is that when you found it, it was a hanging offense. And as our good friend Dr. Johnson in the 18th century said, nothing quite concentrates the mind like hanging. Thank you very much.
Sean, thank you for that superb presentation. And I hope you won't take this as any indicator of our next speakers, but I'm going to close this laptop. Great.
Well, let me say what a pleasure it is to participate in this conference. I've had a long and very privileged association with the Berkeley Centre. I first spent a semester in 1975 when Lyman Glennie was head of the old R&D Centre. And then I spent periods with Martin Trow as the director and with my very good friend Sheldon. I've valued the experience, and so it's a great pleasure to come back. What I want to do very briefly, using the PowerPoint as a structure, is to talk about Australian experience with regard to fees and funding, but set it in a broader context. What I want to talk about is the budgetary challenges that face higher education with mass higher education or rapid expansion. And I want to take a few snapshots from what UNESCO defines as the Asia Pacific region. For this audience, I ought to say the Asia Western Pacific, because UNESCO defines this region without North and South America. It's a vast area of 3 billion or more people, with about 60% of the world's population. Our colleague Martin Trow, back in 1973, wrote a very important paper for UNESCO where he set out what he saw some of the implications of the transition from elite to mass higher education. And that's had a very big impact on international thinking. He pointed out that the social relations change, the social composition of the student body, academic work roles. It's also usually associated with very strong pressures for access, rising retention rates in secondary education. But the other part that we sometimes forget is the very major budgetary implications. Mass higher education, particularly public higher education, is very expensive for even rich societies. And that leads to often conflict, crisis, and difficulties in working out what should be funding policy and what should happen with regard to tuition fees. How do governments respond to these kind of challenges internationally? Well, the obvious one is that public support. Government public funds are channeled to higher education. But what's happened over recent years is that governments have become more sophisticated, cleverer, in how they channel these funds. And instead of just giving annual grants or triennial grants, in Australia, the language has changed. Instead of the government funding higher education, it's now subsidises higher education. Vouchers, loans, performance funding, purchase of places, a variety of different means. Tuition fees are also a very important form of funding. There's a limited number of countries still in the world that don't have tuition fees, but clearly the trend has been towards tuition fees and to increase the amount of tuition fees. Higher education institutions are encouraged to do more to raise their own money through income generation activities, to seek the support of alumni and other donors, and particularly in the developing countries of the world. International donors, other countries, NGOs, are a very important source of funding, not to replace regular funding, but to enable new initiatives and reform to take place. Governments also get the idea of schemes to get greater so-called efficiencies to ensure that higher education institutions do more with less. And sometimes there's efforts to ration access and to seek low-cost alternatives in the form of two-year colleges, two-year degrees in Britain. And then the final one we see around the world is the establishment of private initiatives and private higher education sectors. Even wealthy nations are forced with the challenge at times of deteriorating public funding per student unit, and this has got all kinds of implications. Tuition fees, funding levels have clear implications for access and for quality. Although the research evidence shows that level of tuition fees is not the only factor that affects access. One trend in modern societies is that if funding is somewhat short, there's pressure on governments to increase funding research, and often research has a much greater attraction for governments, particularly for electoral purposes, than just increasing the amount per student unit. The Asia-Pacific area is an area of tremendous variety, and this is reflected in higher education. There is the sophisticated higher education systems of Japan and Korea, and compare this to Bhutan, a small country of less than 1 million people with a single university, which is really just an upgraded teachers' college. Rapid expansion has taken place through this area in the last 10 or 20 years, and I quote there some very impressive figures from China and also Australia. Although in some of the countries, including Japan, there's been a levelling off of increase as systems mature and demography changes. Most governments of the region give a very high emphasis to education, including higher education. On the other hand, a more recent trend is to have major expenditure to try to build world-class universities or centres of excellence. Singapore is an excellent example of massive investment in higher education, particularly in research. This has affected even the poor countries of Asia. I've worked in Vietnam in recent years. Vietnam has been talking to the World Bank about the next $100 million loan. And the government of Vietnam, in informal conversation, suggested to the World Bank, why don't you give us the $100 million and we'll create a world-class university? So this world-class universities has gone across the world. Tuition fees tend to be increasing, although in some countries that have had low tuition fees, it's been very hard to increase these. Private higher education is very important in the Asia-Pacific region. Philippines has something like 80%. Japan, Korea, have Thailand, very well-developed higher education, private sectors. Even Vietnam, which is still a socialist country, has gone to private education. And their estimate is by the year 2020, they want a quarter of the enrolments in private higher education. They don't use the word private higher education. It tends to be people-founded universities. A significant increase in internationalisation and in the use of English. Let me talk just about Australia and three different themes. In 1974, we abolished tuition fees, and for 15 years, we didn't have tuition fees. This was an attempt to increase access. But the research studies show that this didn't change the social composition of the higher education system. 15 years later, another Labor government, socialist government, in a reform effort, decided that we did need student contributions. And so they developed what is, I think, still an innovative form of student tuition fees. That is, students pay their contribution only after graduation and only after their income reaches the average for the total community. And the repayments are through the income tax system. No banks involved. The final thing I want to talk about is since 1990 we've had a major initiative by the Australian government to encourage universities to generate their own income. And one major form of income is through international student fees. Today, 25% of our total enrolments are international students, particularly from Asian countries. This has had financial benefits, but it's also had many other benefits in terms of the social composition of the Australian student body, and also it has served as a major initiative to internationalise curriculum. However, one difficulty for the universities is that they've been so successful in raising their own money. It makes it more difficult to argue for increased public investment in higher education, because the government's inclined to say, you've done so well, just keep doing it, and we could even decrease our subsidy. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. We do have that problem.
Well, let me echo what Grant has said. What a pleasure it is to be here. It's a double pleasure for me because tomorrow I have access to the Bancroft Library archives to look at T.R. McConnell's papers on British higher education, which John referred to earlier. So it's a tremendous pleasure for me to come back and having known T.R. McConnell to actually get real access to his papers. I want to, in a way, slightly demythologize globalization. And I want to suggest that some of the theorizing about globalization in higher education represents a post hoc rationalization of a relatively new, the last 25 years, commercialization of higher education in terms of the recruitment of overseas students. Now, I speak from a British, and it's good that I'm following Grant because he's dealt with some aspects of that in what he said. And I want to suggest that this aspect of globalization actually has some somewhat disturbing aspects in regard to the way universities operate. I want to start by talking about the UK and perhaps my own experience. Because the UK was a kind of leader in the whole question of raising fees for overseas students. We historically had very low to purely nominal fees for overseas students until Margaret Thatcher took power in November 1979. She inherited an economy under siege, the winter of discontent under her predecessor, James Callaghan, where the trades unions had, in effect, run the British economy. And her first action in November 1979, and let me not appear for one moment to be an apologist for the Thatcher regime. Her first action was to introduce quite severe cuts into the whole of the public sector. She appointed a Secretary of State for Education, a rather dim Manchester lawyer, who subsequently became known as a wet and was fired from the job in late 1981. Anyway, on the third day of the Thatcher government, he went to the Treasury to find out what money was going to be available for education, not just higher education, but for education. And he learned that there was to be a £100 million cut in university budgets. I may say that in 1981 there were even further cuts levied, but in 1979 there was a £100 million cut. And a young civil servant, a woman who was on secondment from the post office to the Treasury, said to him, as he looked baffled at how he was going to persuade the university sector for the first time in its history to face up to a cut, she said, "You don't have to. You can simply make overseas students pay full cost fees." And he gave a, reputedly, he gave a sigh. He was off the hook. He continued to be popular. And so he announced a policy that the British government would no longer subsidise the education of overseas students. And this immediately produced a response. My university, which was small, ambitious, and rather go-getting, had 200 overseas students at that time. It now has 2,500, 3,000, I think. And by the middle of 1981, I had an office in Hong Kong recruiting overseas students like you've never seen. Why did we recruit them? It wasn't because we were interested in globalization. It was, as Grant said, we needed the fees. And the fees were tremendously important to us. The fees were important because you could recruit as many overseas students as you wanted. You weren't tied by funding council to a restricted number of home students. We recruited overseas students because we could appoint more academic staff, we could generate more research, we could treat them as profit centres, we could benefit enormously from the resources that they brought in at a time when there was severe cuts in British higher education. Now, we were actually quite careful. We imposed targets on departments. We insisted that overseas students should have the same entry qualifications, which were quite high, as British students. So we were not irresponsible about it. But in practice, that's not what many universities did. Only last Friday, I sat next to a colleague from another university down the road, who'd come into higher education, into his university, from a job in business. He was in the business school. And we were talking about where we were going next week, and he said, "I'm going to Singapore," he said. And I said, I commiserated. He said, no, he said, "We can make a lot of money in Singapore." He said, "You'd be surprised how much university life is like my previous life in business." And what we've seen in, he said, went on about the profit motive and the bottom line and so forth, as if this is what he'd found were the benefits of university life. And of course, what we've done is we've established recruiting agencies around the world. We give the recruiting agencies discounts for the numbers of students they bring us. So there are very profitable little businesses growing up all over the Far East, recruiting students for British universities. And international offices doing this are pretty careful to hide from their vice-chancellors, presidents, all the rather murky details of the arrangements by which these students are being recruited. I want to move on from this to the question of establishing overseas campuses. I've been fortunate in the last year or so to have seen quite a bit of one British university that has got two overseas campuses, and to see quite a bit of one Australian university that has got overseas campuses. Now, these, in each case, the British university has got a campus in China and a campus in Malaysia. The Australian university has got a campus in Malaysia and a campus in South Africa. But this is becoming an increasing trend. There are some 50 universities that are occupying what I think I can only call a commercial park in Dubai as a centre for attracting and teaching overseas students. Now, the motives of the British university were in fact strictly commercial. The motives of the Australian university were said to be entrepreneurial. But in each case, certainly in the case of the British university, who'd attracted very large numbers of students from, say, China, were anxious to protect their market by establishing a campus in China. They said, well, numbers may go down for Chinese wanting to come to Britain, but actually we'll hold up because we've got a campus in China. Both now argue, not that this was a commercial venture, but this is globalization, internationalization, and they both call themselves now globalized universities. And this is a key part of their mission. The four campuses are small. None of them is actually washing their face financially. All of them have generated very heavy setup costs. And if you start looking for parallels, well, I would go back, and I put this in entirely for Sheldon's benefit, because he's a historian. I would go back to the East India Company. The East India Company, trading with the Far East, spices and so forth, coming into London, and they opened an office in India. And the office was to, as it were, manage the trade. But it wasn't long before they decided that what they should do is they should start running the country. We know what the consequences of that were. If you want a modern parallel, British retailer Marks and Spencer's. Marks and Spencer's established, was importing, was using cheap labour in China, and established a small office in Hong Kong to sort of manage this. And then they moved the small office to Shanghai, and now they're spreading Marks and Spencer's branches all across China. So there are kind of commercial parallels to the establishment of overseas campuses. And I think it's really quite important that we ask ourselves, is this kind of activity the kind of activity that we want universities to be in? In fact, what you see when you look at these overseas campuses is that the professors from the home universities don't want to go there. It's disruptive for family life and so forth. So mostly you employ local staff. The local staff are paid, of course, at local rates, not at the rates you'd be paying in Britain or in Australia. The campuses, naturally, because of this, are not research universities. However, they're handing out the name of the university on their degree certificates. So you can get a British university degree out there in China. You can get an Australian university degree in South Africa or in Malaysia. But the students don't actually go anywhere near the universities that are fundamentally responsible for awarding the degrees. I think this raises quite significant issues which have not been given a sufficient airing. I now want to turn to another side of globalization, and a much more positive one. It seems to me that for research universities and for research itself, globalization or internationalization is endemic in the process. If you read Helen Waddell's The Wandering Scholars, a book written in the 1950s about medieval scholars traveling Europe, what you find is that when a new book comes out from Aquinas, what happens? Scholars from all over Europe congregate where Aquinas is writing or where people are interpreting Aquinas. When the new mathematics starts coming into Europe via the Byzantine, by Byzantium after the Crusades, what do you find? You find scholars going to where the new mathematics is being taught. If you look at modern science, The Fly in the Cathedral, which is a book written by Brian Cathcart, which describes the discovery of the atom by Rutherford and his team, what you find is the extraordinary generosity of the collaboration with foreign scholars. People would go to Cambridge and sit in the Cavendish and talk from all over the world, and the Rutherford team would similarly talk all over the world, and out of that, those interchanges came unique discoveries, Nobel Prizes, and so forth. You'd find exactly the same if you read The Double Helix about the whole process of discovering molecular biology in Cambridge. You would see it, to quote a Berkeley name, in John Heilbronn's book, The Upright Man, about Max Planck, and the extent to which Max Planck had contacts all over the world in science. What we see, therefore, at the research level is the transmission of ideas, and the transmission of ideas very generously. If I go back to my own experience, I had an occasion when I had to overrule my finance officer because a professor of physics asked to use part of the research grant money he got to put a telephone in his car. Finance officer naturally thought this was a gross luxury, and the professor of physics came to me and said, well, actually, the problem is I'm collaborating with three American universities, and they telephone me just as I'm on my way home, and I need to have a phone in the car between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock, because that's when my research collaboration takes place. A good example of the extent to which technology affects globalization in the research field. And so what I would say then is that globalization, we have always had it in research. It's become enhanced by technology, but it's as old as the hills. It's what we've been doing in research environments ever since there were research environments. So I think we need to distinguish between globalization, which is commercialization, and globalization, which is essentially all about the transfer of ideas. And I think we've got to ask a few questions about where this commercialism is taking us, and is it putting in jeopardy the academic integrity of our universities, and is this actually the route that we really want to go down. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Irvin, and thank you very much, Judd, particularly for inviting me to come to these two conferences. I'm not a scholar in these issues. I have been in policymaking all my life and have enjoyed that very, very much, dealing with higher education and research, particularly research and science policy. I'd like to make a few comments to what has been said by my colleagues, and I listened really with great interest to them. First, Sheldon was talking about the access issues, and I just want to say that we have been working a lot with that in Sweden to get non-privileged groups into higher education. We have been partly successful. We have, in the last 10 years, we have raised the proportion of students with a working class background from 18% to 24%. Still, we can see that there are few students with a working class background going into the very prestigious programs, such as medicine, for example, veterinary medicine, and so on. And I think what we talked about in the former conference was really that many of the problems are not the problems in higher education, but are problems at the lower levels of the educational system, such as the upper secondary school. At least that is the case in my country, and that's really where people are making their choices. Then I want to say something about whether the issue whether globalization, internationalization is something new. Michael was talking about in research, of course, research has always been very international in character. And I think that also not only the technological development, but also the increase in big science and big science installations, I think, has really contributed to the increased international cooperation in research. But really, whether internationalization and globalization of higher education is new or not, I think it depends on the time frame and what the magnitude of the different components of internationalization, such as students and teachers exchange, and mobility, change in curriculum and teaching methods, and so on. And it also depends on the objectives. And I think we've heard here this morning that, of course, there's a new element now into the objectives of cross-border higher education, and that is an economic one, looking at, for example, Australia. But definitely, the if you look at student mobility, there is an increase, a definite increase. There was a recent study by the OECD on this showing that number of foreign students in the OECD area between 1998 and 2004 rose by 70% to 2.3 million students. And we have also seen that we made a recent study in Sweden on the cross-border cooperation or exchange in higher education. And we see that particularly the number of students coming to Sweden has increased. Particularly we have students from Germany, Finland, and France, but also increasingly from the Asian countries. But where are the U.S. students? You know, that's one question that I asked at the other conference also. We don't see them that often in Sweden. And foreign students, it must be said, do not pay a fee. There is no tuition fee for foreign students, nor for Swedish students, of course. And we have been discussing the issue of fees, whether to introduce them, at least for foreign students, because people argue, why should Swedish taxpayers also pay for foreign students? But we haven't done it, and maybe we'll do it later on also for Swedish students. But the argument that I think that Grant Harman put forward, the reason why I think the ministers in charge of higher education have not been wanting to do it is that immediately there would be a cut from the Ministry of Finance. So what would we earn, you know, from this? So I think that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
I want to thank our panelists for four very insightful presentations. And also, I must say, I've chaired many panels, but I've never seen as much substance compressed into such a short period of time. These were brilliant vignettes, which I'm sure each could speak at much greater length. It does leave me some time for some comments, which I would have taken anyway. And again, it ties into to kind of the subtitle of this session, which really relates to internationalization and globalization, kind of the past and the present. And I too, will try and modestly step into this role of kind of historian. Daniel Fallon's background piece for the conference that we had the last 2 days, which is really on the German experience, begins with a kind of vignette, and I hope I have this correct, of two Americans in the early 19th century, George Trichter and Edward Everett, who are looking for advanced studies, advanced degrees, and of course could not find it in the United States, and so travel to Europe and especially to Germany. So if you like, in terms of internationalizing their education, U.S. nationals had to go overseas to learn. I recently participated in an NSF study on publication trends of bibliometric study of kind of the role of U.S. researchers in the world literature. And what's very striking about the data is, first of all, the U.S. share of publications, again, an ISI type of indices, has declined. There has been a noticeable trend in co-authorship. Again, these are, I think, well-known trends. But also there's been an increase in co-authorship between U.S. researchers and researchers in other countries. So to that extent, the internationalization, the globalization, is occurring. I mean, it's a clear trend, simply because if you want to do high-quality research, you have to work with other high-quality researchers, and researchers are located across the world, and therefore you find increased collaboration in terms of the dynamics of science. As Kirsten said, in part, this is driven by big science, but it's also driven essentially by the mobility of people. Several years ago, I was participating in an NSF study on the role of engineering research in technological innovation, and I had the privilege of interviewing Don Peterson, I guess, of the Electrical Engineering Department at Berkeley, who talked about the moving van theory of technology transfer and talked about how students out of that department, and this related to SPICE and its contribution to the development of computer-assisted design, how essentially as they took the knowledge they had learned and began to migrate out into firms in the Bay Area and throughout California, how this really helped transform firms and industries and helped launch several industries. And so this moving van theory of technology transfer, I think, has a very powerful kind of model, and in many ways it's an antidote to the patent and licensing kind of paradigm that we talk much about. But it also relates to science. It also relates essentially to patterns of international collaboration, if you like, internationalization of science, because essentially what you are forming here are social networks of mentors and their students, and their students become, train other students, and basically we are now forming international networks, international collaboration of science. And I think this is really what each of our other panelists have been talking about. It is facilitated by technology. I mean, to only have to worry about a three-hour time delay between, let's say, the UK and the US is simple, compared to, you know, collaborating with colleagues in India or China or Japan or Australia. But basically, you now collaborate with researchers around the world, and it's made much easier, obviously, by the Internet. So which suggests, one, this is a process that is there. It is going to continue. The cost of communication, of data transmission, of collaboration are much easier. It also suggests, and here in terms of a U.S. perspective, that the competitiveness or the standing of any single nation in this truly global world and global competitive world for preeminence or standing in science is going to be tied to the quality of the students and the researchers from other countries that they are able to attract to do their studies, to come visit, which is a function in part of visas and part of fees, but is also part of the hospitality to the receptivity of a place to people from other regions. And so diversity is not only a moral imperative, in many ways it becomes an important part of a nation's competitive capacity over time, especially in science. But I think there's a downside to this, the globalization, the internationalization, which was touched upon briefly in our workshop the other day, but I just want to highlight it. Implicitly, when we talk about internationalization and globalization, we're talking about communication in English. Basically, we're talking about communication not only of U.S. nationals with researchers and colleagues in other countries in terms of English, but we're also talking about communication among nationals of other countries in English. I mentioned the other day that I participated in a conference in Pisa of European researchers. Again, I was the only American at the conference, and the participants were from the UK out to Romania, representatives from Japan and Israel. The entire discourse over 3 days was in English. Now, it certainly reduces the transactions cost for an American, particularly for somebody of my age. It really does make it, you know, a lot easier. But where it has a kind of two-part impact, a negative impact, I think in two ways. One, I think it makes life a little too easy for Americans. Basically, it really says it is increasingly easier for an American not only to travel abroad, but more importantly, to collaborate with researchers in other countries simply by remaining skilled only in English and not making that investment in foreign languages and not seeing the value of having one's children or grandchildren learn other languages. The other, and here I made reference to this the other day, but it ties into this kind of new performance management and accountability that we've heard about, accountability systems that we've heard before, and that is the extent to which all countries are aspiring to have world-class universities. What does that mean? The performance metric of a world-class university in country after country is defined by performance in bibliometrics. ISI. I mean, there are some other measures, but the power of these indices, of these indicators, I think can be found in many, many countries. What this means is that some fields, some disciplines, international communication is already largely in terms of English. One publishes in English language journals. But there are well-documented cases. If one is going to do social science research, if one is going to do humanities research, and publish in one's native language, home language, these works do not receive the citations in the major indices. What this means, and again, I mention this in part because I participated in a project in Iceland trying to build kind of world-class institutions there. And it was a clear issue. I mean, this is a country of 750,000 people. Essentially, what you would find is that if you try to publish only in the kind of ISI type of journals, you really put pressure on the vitality of the historic native national language. And the same thing has been found for other countries. So there is, I think, an issue here that globalization, internationalization, which leads to increases in scientific productivity, does have some potential costs to countries. The other part about internationalization, here I just speak as a researcher, and it's the theme of the workshop yesterday, is we have so much to learn as Americans from the work that's going on in other countries. My own work is on the economics of R&D and performance measurement and kind of the role of kind of the Office of Management and Budgets, kind of new evaluation of research and development sort of thing. And it's very clear that OMB is operating in a neoclassical economic model from, you know, Ken Arrow and Dick Nelson, the sort of thing that, you know, I learned, you know, when I went to graduate school, that I have taught to many of my students, that I have written on. It's very clear that this is just an all-powerful paradigm, and we basically repeat it, okay, because this is what we know. When I interact, when I either sit in sessions listening to European researchers or I participate in workshops involving EU projects, I hear totally different models. I hear about knowledge management. I hear about behavioral additionality as addition to input additionality or output additionality. These are different frameworks. They're very important frameworks. They have a kind of intellectual validity. They can be empirically tested. In other words, one can do good social science with very important policy implications once one is introduced to these frameworks. So however big and however diverse we might think of the United States in terms of number of institutions, in fact, in many respects, we do have in our disciplines intellectual boundaries, intellectual borders, which really don't permit us to understand that there are alternative frameworks, some of which I don't think are particularly good, but some of which I've already found to be very, very valuable in my own work and now kind of engaged in trying to, you know, write and trying to have influence in the term. In fact, it's quite interesting that several of the Americans who work in this tradition seem to have migrated to Europe because I think intellectually they have not been able to find a home in the United States, including some very distinguished researchers. Finally, let me just make a different type of observation. We talked a lot about the role of higher education in terms of culture, in terms of its civic contribution, besides contributions to knowledge and economic development. And this may be a comment that seems trivial and obvious at a place like Berkeley or in California, or where I come from originally in New York, and that is we have ethnic diversity. People come from lots of different countries. Look at the audience, the student composition. In many parts of the country, we're really dealing with very homogeneous populations. We're really dealing with people who really have very narrow kind of interaction with people unlike themselves. I mean, my university is located in central Pennsylvania, State College, Pennsylvania. It's a lovely place. You know, I've lived there since the 1960s, and I have no intention of moving. When I first moved there in 1960, this is kind of a Maslowian hierarchy. They didn't have access to the New York Times, and they had no decent bread. Okay, now over time, civilization has reached, and literally, my first 2 years there, I would make a run into New York City every 6 weeks to load up. I was known as the bagel man. I would come back with a car loaded with bagels and bread and all the basic substance, you know, of life, okay? We now have those things, okay? But over time, as the university has grown and as we have had faculty and students from more and more countries, especially increasingly from Asian countries, the whole dynamics, the whole sense of living in State College has become different. Essentially, what it means is not simply in terms of faculty meetings, in terms of who are your neighbors, who your kids play with, what sort of worlds and what sort of attitudes they are exposed to, just begins to change. And I mentioned the judge. I heard the chancellor yesterday, former Chancellor Hyman, talk about rankings, the importance of rankings, and you know, if a Berkeley department dropped out of the top 10, you know, it was essentially terminated overnight. I told the judge that I travel. I've been on a fair number of universities, and I have my own ranking measure. It's the fellow wine measure. It's the quality of the wine served at a reception. That I had been at another university, a low-ranking institution, not too long ago, where they had served some jug wine. Because it was manufactured in California, I won't mention it. Judd, you know, at the reception, the very gracious reception the other night, had Sonoma Couture and La Creme, which was really, you know, quite nice. No Merlot, of course. Well, I have a similar measure in State College. Several years ago, there was on the main commercial street, there was a Dunkin' Donuts opened, okay, and this is not exactly high cuisine, okay? That went out of business after several years and was replaced by a Kenny Rogers, okay? That went out of business. Now, about 2 years ago, a Korean restaurant, Kim Chi, opened. And my only problem is I cannot get into the place because it is so busy. It has added so much to the quality of life. In fact, one night I drove there to have dinner. I literally could not get into the parking lot, and I ended up at a TGI Fridays, and that was terrible. But what it is that, and now other people have the opportunity to, I'm not saying that food is cultural or that if you eat multiple cuisines, you're going to be a more cosmopolitan or more enlightened individual. I'm not suggesting that. I'm simply suggesting that internationalization changes the complexion, and I don't mean that in any kind of, you know, cute sense. It changes the composition of the people with whom you deal. And so instead of talking about 6 degrees of separation, I think increasingly we're talking about 6 degrees of closeness. And that's a contribution that universities make to a place because they bring people together from different places and allow them to interact and therefore learn from one another. Thank you. Okay.
Susanna Lohmann from UCLA. I have a question about public universities and internationalization. When you look at the land grants when they were founded in the 19th century, one of the things that was very stunning about them was that they were not just simply focused towards local or state communities, but you find in many of their mission statements an incredible international outlook that we are here for the world, not just for the local community. So let's say if you look at the mission statement of Iowa State, for example, which was one of the first land grants, what I'm concerned about is whether the publics today might have become quite parochial compared to, for example, private universities. And the reason is that they are so focused on sort of proving to their state legislators, you know, that we provide jobs for the state and stuff like that. But there might be other reasons too. Let's say if you compare, for instance, UCLA and USC in Los Angeles, USC has unbelievably high numbers of foreign students, obviously for tuition purposes, but that also means they have them, whereas UCLA obviously is limited in the number of foreign students that we can have, simply because, you know, the California taxpayer is not going to support that. Or let's say if you have primarily private universities founding campuses in other countries, and I totally take Michael Shattuck's point on this, but I can also think of tons of examples like Carnegie Mellon in India and so on, where it's not just simply a commercial thing, but it's really an exchange of ideas and research thing too. And so I'm really wondering if the publics now are actually falling behind in this internationalization process compared to the privates.
Interesting set of questions, Susan. I don't necessarily think so, despite everything that you've rightly pointed to. I'd also like to say that I do recognize that foreign students in some countries are bringing in fees, and they might very well do so here, but that there is a shortage of American students willing to go for PhDs in some engineering subjects and science subjects, in which students from other countries are stepping into that gap, many of whom stay and end up in Silicon Valley to our great benefit and joy. So it isn't just fees, it is also the fact that sometimes American students are not filling the places that are available to them. The land-grant university, Berkeley, certainly fits into that category. What is interesting about the land-grant legislation is how it was written by Congress. It did not say what a university could not do. It only said what a land-grant university, those who had received either the land or the proceeds from the sale of the land that the federal government owned, it owned most of the land the United States still does, the legislation only said they must teach certain subjects. It did not say they could not teach others. They had to be A&Ms, agriculture and mechanical engineering institutions. So Berkeley was, if you like, an A&M. In the meantime, immediately we started teaching Latin. Incidentally, the first courses taught in university extension here, and now extension has to be a market-driven enterprise, the very first courses were in Shakespeare on the Berkeley campus. Very interesting. So immediately what happened is you create a university, the federal legislation says certain subjects must be taught, and the university says, fine, we'll teach them, and we'll teach everything else as well, because by then the German ideas of what a university should do, and other ideas, Scottish as well, had come into the United States. So it was, if you like, the brilliance of the legislation, which did not forbid you from doing what you could do. I think that in the last few days in our workshops, we have been asking the questions about whether, in some sense, publics can keep up with privates, and I do. I am myself a kind of business cycle. I go up and down on this issue. I'm rather optimistic today. Tomorrow I may be pessimistic. But I'm optimistic because what one sees in the long-run history of universities is how, when an institution really sets its mind to solving or addressing particular kinds of new problems, it really does. Yeah, not all do it equally. But the ones that have a heritage do. Our Clark Kerr, who I think is still the greatest of American university presidents, noted many times and in his memoirs that the universities of the United States that were great in 1910 were great in 2008. Okay? That included some of the publics, that they had found a way to maintain their reputations despite crises. If you look at the long history of Berkeley, it's been one crisis after another, from almost strangled in the cradle. 10 years after the University of California was found, that it was almost ended in a fight between the agricultural interests and the urban professional interests, and a new constitution emerged. And it went through subsequent crises all the time, and after the Second World War, continually. Those of us who came here, I came in to teach here in 1963, immediately met a crisis that American universities had never faced before in the student rebellions. It was against anything that any of us had ever experienced, thought about, or written about. It seemed so unnatural to this country. And immediately there was talk of how that was really the end of Berkeley. And Nobody would come here to teach and the rest of it. Indeed, a number of very distinguished people left, but they would have left anyhow for reasons I could go into. Immediately, we recruited other outstanding people. The university's reputation soared. I think one has to have a little faith in more than 1 year, okay? There are patterns and cycles. And as someone wisely said, there are ups and then there are downs.